Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
All right, so there are a few days on the sports calendar to me that are more overhyped and overrated than NFL schedule release day. I've said this before, I'm going to say it again right now. Everybody already knows which teams are playing each other this season, so NFL schedule release day is really just NFL, what day is that thing happening? Day. The only thing worse than when the schedule release day is when people start dissecting it and then making predictions based on it. And by the way, this is not a new thing. This is not something people started to do because of the pandemic. This is something people have always done. If you want to tell me it matters when a team's bye week is, I might listen. If you want to tell me that it matters when a team's Thursday night game is, I might listen. But other than that, I'm out. Don't waste my time. And yet somehow in May, people think it matters that you've got the Giants going 5-11 or 6-10. Here's what matters when it comes to the Giants schedule. Somehow, some way, they've got two primetime games. I'm not sure how they pulled that. It makes no sense whatsoever. Look, I mean, I like Saquon Barkley. He's a superstar, tremendous guy. But two primetime games for a team that averages four wins a year seems like too many. It seems like a really heavy price that the rest of us have to pay. The hell did we all do to deserve any of that? Give at least one of those games to the Buffalo Bills. That way they can be tied for most in the NFL. Right now they've got four, and they're four good ones. KC, San Francisco, New England, Pittsburgh. And as good as that is, it's still not enough. And there won't be nearly enough tables in Buffalo this year. And there aren't nearly enough primetime games for Cleveland. America needs to see America's team, period. And yes, I am still riding with Baker and the fellas. And no, it's not news that Tampa Bay, has five primetime games. Of course they do. When you look at how hard Tampa is working to keep his name in the news, you think the league is going to bury him with a bunch of 1 p.m. Eastern kickoffs? Hell no. And no, I'm not really into hearing the detailed breakdowns of the fact that the Colts open up by only facing one playoff team in their first seven games. I mean, yeah, I guess that might be something. And then it might be nothing at all. Just like I know the Raiders have six kickoffs at 10 a.m. Pacific. Yeah, cool. Great. You got 4 months to get ready for that. Go do it. It doesn't really matter that the Jets open up with the Bills and the 49ers. Probably not. What I'm saying is, schedule release day has always been boring, overblown, overhyped. Even the teams seem to know this. So last year, the teams started to shake it up. Last year, the teams started to drop videos of the schedule announcements, and some of them actually were pretty damn good. Remember, Baltimore went with that monster truck rally announcement.
Football fans, this fall, prepare to get annihilated as John Harbaugh and his pet Ravens rise and conquer proudly present the Baltimore Ravens 2019 football schedule, featuring your favorite players against your least favorite teams. Your Ravens start their engines.
Saturday. Not bad at all. Even the Cowboys went with that ASMR announcement.
I'm Jerry Jones, and this is the Dallas Cowboys 2019 schedule release.
The New York Giants. The Washington Redskins. The Miami Dolphins.
I see you working, Gramps. So the bar had been raised for this year. Unfortunately, a lot of teams impaled themselves on that same bar. Look, I get it. It's a really unusual year. The schedule itself comes with a lot of question marks. Everybody's working from home. But man, I've got to say, with all that in mind, some of these videos sucked. Cincinnati apparently really loved that clip of Joe Burrow smoking a cigar after the national championship game because they went with a cigar-themed announcement. Every team was a cigar band on a cigar. Yeah, all right. cool first draft, fellas. When are you coming with the real announcement? The Detroit Lions went with a planet Earth theme. Get it? Because they're the Lions.
Cloaked in grandeur and splendor, and with high hopes on the horizon, the Lion begins his odyssey. This is Planet Lions. Prepare to see the animal kingdom in a whole new light.
Yeah, you think that's bad? That thing goes on for like more than 8 minutes. Their schedule release video is longer than the highlights of the Matt Patricia era. Patriots, in true Patriot fashion, simply released a still image of their schedule. Any other year, that'd be the most tired thing ever. This year, it was actually better than a bunch of the actual videos. Because the Bears went with some really weird animated thing that's right on brand for them. If their on-the-field product is anywhere near as lame as their draft video, and it might be, you can go ahead and assume another wasted year of all of your lives in Chicago. Number of teams went with tributes to medical personnel or directly addressed the current crisis, which makes sense. But overall, if I'm grading on a curve, even then, there wasn't much to get excited about when it comes to the release of the videos overall. A couple of teams went with a channel-changing motif to capture both their schedule and the fact that everybody is at home watching TV right now. The Eagles did it pretty well with their mascot flipping through clips on a tablet. Veep for Washington, Curb Your Enthusiasm for the Rams, and wait for it, the extremely tired Joe Exotic reference for the Bengals, but they did redeem themselves with The Wire for their Week 6 game against Baltimore.
Philadelphia Eagles!
What a journey we are about to begin. And how does a journey begin? With a first step. So watch my foot.
Oh. Oh. A traveling tip. Try not to wear shorts.
'Cause I saw Tiger.
Anyway, Baltimore follows up the monster truck rally, though, with an incredible game show mashup announcement. That was nice.
Anytime, any place.
Price is Right, Double Dare, Password, Trivial Pursuit, Family Feud, it was all there. But leave it to the Carolina Panthers to come up with a masterpiece, which sums up the experience for a lot of people right now. The caption is, bored in the house, but counting the days until our Sunday best. And it's a day in the life video, starting with the first matchup being spelled out in alphabet cereal in milk.
Feeling good, like I should be. When in Durka walk around the neighborhood, feeling blessed.
I just want to let everyone know that week two, the Carolina Bigcats will be playing the Buccaneers down there in Florida. Carol Baskins better not.
I'll even overlook the played-out Tiger King reference in Week 2 because they bounced right back with a clever TikTok announcement for another matchup and a fever dream that includes Dennis Rodman's strategy for rebounds. So what I'm saying is this. 2 years into the schedule release video trend, and we've already got two clear leaders, Baltimore and Carolina. They're getting it done, even in challenging circumstances. Everybody else is chasing these two and still has a hell of a lot of work to do if they're going to run down those two top dogs. And circling back, watching that 8 minute Lions video was like stopping on a whammy.
Big bucks, no whammies, stop!
Stop it, oh, whammy.
Look, I know it's strategy, but is there a bigger coward move than passing your spins to another contestant because you've built this fat bankroll and you're afraid of the whammy?
Scared coward.
Scared coward. Biggest coward move ever. Man, sack up and get your color TV. Clones, Capital One knows that life does not alert you about your credit card. Hey, couch surfers, we've got nonstop tunes to keep you rocking while you work. Oh, and Colleen. Yes, you, Colleen with a K. Your free trial of a Movie Plus ends tomorrow, and your card may be charged. Do you want to continue or cancel? So, meet Eno, the Capital One assistant. Eno looks out for surprise charges, like when free trials expire, and it helps you if you need to fix them. Eno, another way Capital One is watching out for your money when you are not. Capital One, what's in your wallet? Limitations do apply. Ramona Shelburne is my guest. Ramona, it is great to have you on the program. Before I ask you about the piece you've got up right now about Michael Jordan and Kobe Bryant, let me ask you, how are you and your family doing in the middle of this pandemic?
We're doing good, you know? Like, I haven't even filled my car up with gas since we all shut down, right? So we just stay home, and I go for walks with my son. He's, like, 19 months old, so, like, I mean, we're just kind of, like, all toddler all the time right now. And then in between, my husband and I just, like, trade off with, you know, watching him and then go for a lot of walks so I know, like, all the dogs in the neighborhood. I don't know.
I like
sounds
it.
About right.
That's good. That sounds about right. That's good. So you haven't filled your car up, probably haven't washed it, and you get some time with the family, which is key. Ramona Shelburne is my guest. All right, so most of the world knew that Michael and Kobe had a relationship, but a lot of folks were surprised that Michael was as emotional as he was at Kobe's memorial. You're as plugged in as anybody in the game of basketball. So what was your sense of their relationship before you saw Michael and the way he reacted at that memorial?
I got to be honest, Jim, I had no idea. You know, I was pretty close to Kobe, you know, the last 4 or 5 years of his career. And then after he retired, I asked him about Michael many times. And he would say things like, yeah, he's like my big brother. You know, we talk, we're close. But he never expanded on it, right? Like, you know, when somebody's your really good friend, you tell stories about them, you give details, like, it was always just like something you would say. It was always, yeah, he's like my big brother, right? So I just thought it was a figure of speech. Like I thought, yeah, they probably talked or text messaged a few times. But I was sitting there at the celebration of life for Kobe. And when I think we all started to get a sense of this when, you know, do you remember when Michael got up from his seat and helped Vanessa down
sure.
from the podium?
Right.
And I was like, oh.
Really
oh,
nice.
They're like family.
Right.
And then he got up and gave this eulogy that, I mean, I got to be honest, like, I was in tears already, but like that really got me, you know, like that was from the heart. And I think we all realized like, wow, they had a really true, deep relationship that, they were probably, the right word is probably protective of, right? Like, you know, I understand Kobe not wanting to divulge everything about his relationship with Michael to me or anyone else in the press. Like he would say things like he mentored me, he taught me things, but not details. Because once you unearth that, once you open that door and peel back those layers, like that's all we're going to talk about. We're going to start comparing you to Michael again. And, you know, I get why they were protective of it.
Ramona Shelburne is joining us. I agree with you. I had no idea. And I knew Kobe a little bit as well, but I never heard him talk about that. So they were able to keep that really quiet and they protected the nature of that relationship. In terms of the comparisons, you just touched on this. Like Tim Grover told you that from his standpoint, the connection began simply with Kobe waiting for Mike after games. Other guys would say they wanted Jordan to mentor them, but it seems like nobody connected with them the way Kobe did. Why was that? How was Kobe able to get Mike's attention?
Well, you know, I think it's like, you know, when somebody, I bet you get like 20 people who hit you all the time saying, you know, hey, I'm a college student, you know, I want to pick your brain. Can I get some advice? Right. Like I get people like that all the time. I try to be a good mentor, right? I try to say, all right, hey, let's jump on the phone sometime. Let's talk. And I can usually tell within like a couple of minutes whether this person is like serious or not. Right. Or if they just want to talk or they think it would be cool to work in sports. I think it was a lot like that with Mike. Like, I think it's not just that he waited for him after the game or that he was persistent. It was just the entire way that he went about things, right? It was the entire way that he pursued his craft. He was a sponge looking for detail. I mean, even in the documentary that we just saw on Sunday, you know, in episode 5, like, Michael's making fun of Kobe, right? In that locker room, he's like, yeah, that little Laker boy wants to take everybody one-on-one. I mean, that's a hilarious description of him, right? But like, there's also something that's kind of endearing about it, right? Like he recognizes the ferocity in the way that like Kobe's like, he just wants to take everybody one-on-one. Like, you know, I think he saw a kindred spirit in Kobe. He saw the eagerness that Kobe had, but he also saw the persistence. And that to me was, you know, what jumps off the page. Like when Tim Grover was, I love the quote from Grover where he says, you know, Michael thought everybody was annoying, but it's how he said it when he talked about Kobe. Like, that little guy's annoying, but he means it in a good way, right? Because like, he kept pestering him for advice.
No, he respected it. It was endearing. Ramona Shelburne is joining us. I think you're right. And it would be so easy to see this maybe as a one-way street where Jordan was mentoring and teaching Kobe. But do you get the sense that Jordan learned from Kobe as well? And if so, what did he learn from Kobe?
Yeah, I mean, he told you in his own words at the during his eulogy, right? I mean, you know, in a lot of ways that he looks at Kobe Bryant's life, and Kobe really handled retirement very well. He really handled the second phase of his career very well. I don't know if I would argue better than Michael, because Michael's made a whole lot of money and owns an NBA franchise, right? But Kobe looked at the way Michael retired and unretired twice and said, I'm not going to do that. I remember him telling me the last year of his career, we were doing a big story on, you know, kind of what he was moving into. And he said, you know, I tore my Achilles. That was when I realized I was going to have to start planning for the next part of my life. And I was going to have to start focusing in on that. And I was, because I'm no way I'm retiring without a plan and a purpose. And he said, I've been searching for that for 15 years, but now the rubber's meeting the road, right? Now it's time. I really got to focus on this. And I think that's a direct result of watching Michael sort of be lost and aimless as he, you know, tried to confront the end of his basketball career. The Wizards years, like Kobe never wanted that. Now, you could argue Kobe's last couple years were kind of like Michael's Wizards years, right? He wasn't very good. He'd lost that athleticism. He was mostly just hurt. But he was, the whole time that he was in his last Laker contract, he was planning for Kobe Inc. He was planning for life after basketball. And I think he was attacking that with passion and purpose. He championed time management when it comes to your family and work-life balance, right? I mean, we've all been swapping Kobe stories since he passed. And one of my favorites is how he would always leave the office around 2 o'clock every day because he wanted to pick his kids up from school. But, you know, Kobe's not going to be waiting in line to pick his kids up from school. He had to be the first car in line. He's not going to wait in that line of other parents, right? But, like, he would leave the office, like, you know, religiously at 2 o'clock so he could be there to pick up his kids. And it was something that was important to him. He made time for it. He prioritized it. Jordan said that in his eulogy. He just said, you know, I'm a grandfather now. I've got two, and he also has 2 6-year-old twins. He goes, I can't wait to go home and be a girl dad. I can't wait to go home and be a better family man. I mean, that's a direct result of him watching how Kobe did it.
Ramona Shelburne is joining us. Well done. Such a good piece. Listen, while I have you on, before I let you go, you also have a piece up this morning about the fact that some facilities are opening up around the league. The list of teams opening today is very fluid. It's changing by the minute. Mm-hmm. What exactly can happen in these facilities that are open today?
Yeah, not much. I mean, to be honest, like one GM said to me, you know, this is more about mental health than anything, right? This is like, guys have been in their apartments. They don't necessarily have a hoop. Like sometimes you could find an outdoor hoop, but at least where we are, Jim, in California, like those are closed. I mean, you can go around and there's police tape on outdoor hoops, right? So this is about getting players who don't have access to private gyms or who don't have access to outdoor hoops at their house or something, just the ability to go into the practice facility. And it's really, really managed. Like, you know, in Cleveland, for example, there's one way in and one way out, right? You can't go back. So you have your scheduled practice time. You show up at the front door. There's no door. Like I think they took the door off so you can like walk in, but you don't have to touch anything.
Right? Crazy.
The Miami Heat's going to open up on Monday. You know, they said they're going to have basketballs where they write your name on the basketball and like that's your basketball. No one else is touching your basketball. And you're not touching anybody else's basketball. I mean, this is like the level of cleanliness and restrictions that people have right now. How about this one? When you show up for practice, you kind of have to come fully dressed because you can't use the locker room. So you have to be like ready. You can't just like show up in your nice clothes, change into something else. You have to show up ready to go. And then no shower at the end. There's no access to the wet areas or the shower areas or locker rooms. So you have to just like leave all sweaty and get back in your car. Like, that's what this is going
to
be like.
All right, so if that's what all this is like, the players you're talking to, do they think this is worth their time and their energy given what they get out of this compared to what they have to put into it? Or are these people like, these guys like, I got to get the hell out of my house. I really don't care. I'm going to get up a few shots.
Yeah. So I think here's the big issue, which people don't want to like admit to you on the record, but they will tell you off the record. Players were finding places to shoot. Okay.
Sure.
They were getting their old high school coach to open up.
Ramona, like without all that stuff, right? Without all the restrictions.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Like they were getting, and that's actually why the NBA felt like it wanted to get practice facilities open back up. Like, who do you trust more to keep a safe environment? You know, the team facilities that are being following all these CDC protocols and all these safety restrictions, or like your high school coach is like, yeah, here's the key. You can go in after midnight. Just make sure nobody sees you.
And then it comes down to like your threshold, right? How concerned you are. Some guys are less concerned. Mm-hmm. They want to get their work in. So let me finally ask you this. Like, is it for mental health? Is it something that the league is trying to do for players? Or does it actually move us closer to a probable or potential start date for the league? I mean, does it mean anything with regards to the league starting up?
I think any forward momentum is good momentum, right? Theoretically, you could see this and just be like, this is stupid. This is like a whole, a 20-page manual just to shoot in a mostly empty gym with a player development coach wearing a mask and gloves. Like, that is really far away from full contact NBA basketball, right? Like, that doesn't seem to be all that much closer. But I live in I'm more of an optimistic person, Jim. Like, I think any momentum is forward momentum. And that doesn't mean we're not going to have backward momentum at some point too, right? Like, you could open them back up, a couple people could test positive, and we have to shut everything down again. Like, that could absolutely happen. But I really believe this entire thing comes down to psychology and also politics, right? So right now, players are still in a place where they're like, is there a scenario where we can make the risk where it's quote-unquote safe? And there's no scenario where the risk is going to be zero, okay? There's only a risk tolerance, like wrapping your head around, can we live in a world with a virus? Can we mitigate risk? Can we feel safe in that way, knowing that the virus is still out there? That's what the NBA is trying to get to, and I think the only way you get to that is by testing. But testing right now is a very political issue because there are not enough of them around the country. And in order to really test players, staffers, anybody who'd be involved, you have to test them with rapid test results, and you have to test them often, maybe even daily. So that's going to take, it's going to take a lot of tests, right? It's not just, can we get 20 tests for each team? It's, can we get 20,000 tests? And taking 20,000 tests off the market right now is not something the NBA is going to do, even though theoretically they could. They could buy them from any lab they want to, but I don't think that they're going to be on the wrong side of history on this.
No, the optics would not be great. Senior writer at ESPN, an NBA insider, a three-time academic All-American at Stanford, once again helped lead Stanford to the Women's College World Series, and she is the reporter and host of the Webby-nominated Sterling Affairs podcast. Ramona, so great to have you on the show. I really appreciate the conversation. Great to talk to you, and very well done.
Yeah, me too. It's been good to be on your show. I actually was on your show once, but then Jason Smith was there. I was like, I'm on the Jim Rome show without Jim Rome, so this is great. We finally crossed.
I'm so glad we did that, Ramona. I've been looking forward to doing that for a long time. Ariel Helwani is my guest. Ariel, before we talk about UFC 249, let me first ask you, how are you and your family doing right now as we continue to deal with the pandemic?
Oh, thank you for asking, Jim. I appreciate that. Thank God everyone's doing well. I appreciate that, and I hope the same for you and the rest of your staff.
Absolutely. Thanks for saying so. We are doing well, and it's good to hear you and yours are too. All right, so UFC 249, the weigh-ins took place earlier today in Jacksonville. How would you describe the weigh-ins, and how different were they from what you normally see when you see a weigh-in?
Honestly, not that much different. Usually a pay-per-view weigh-in, they'll have the morning weigh-ins, the official weigh-ins, if you will, where they actually step on the scale and check their weights and all that stuff. And then later on in the day, they'll have something called a ceremonial weigh-in where the fans are in attendance. Usually that's at the arena and they'll do the face-offs. They're not doing that this time around. So they just had the morning official weigh-in at the hotel. Not a lot of pomp and circumstance. Public wasn't allowed to attend. Very few media. And the media that was there, they were a little further away from each other than normal. Some of the fighters weighed in wearing masks. One weighed in wearing masks and gloves. Some weighed in wearing no masks, no gloves. So it just kind of ranged. And then afterwards, they had the face-offs, and Dana White was there and a little surprised, you know, shaking everyone's hand and fist bumps and no masks and all that stuff. But, you know, I guess they're going to fight tomorrow. So at this point, what does it matter?
Ariel Helwani is joining us. You know, that is interesting. So what is your sense as to how frequently the athletes are being tested? And for those who do not know, what are those tests like?
Yeah, so they all showed up either Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday, all the fighters and their teams, to the hotel in Jacksonville. And upon checking in, they had to take basically three tests. Number one, they got their temperature checked. And they got their temperature checked every single day. In order to have a credential to be on the premises, you had to get your temperature checked. But also, they got an antibody test, which is basically them, you know, pricking your finger and taking some blood. You get the results of that test back in 10 to 15 minutes. And the point of that test is to determine whether or not you had COVID-19, not whether or not you have it. Then finally, the worst one of them all is they do that swab test, which you may have seen, where they stick that long kind of Q-tip like thing up your nose. They say it tickles your brain. It looks miserable. And that test determines whether or not you have it. And so they've taken that. And then right after the weigh-ins, they took it a second time, just the fighters. And so the interesting thing is they all got the results of the antibody test because, like I said, you get it back in 10 to 15 minutes. But they were told, you know, we'll call you if, you know, you test positive for COVID-19 from the swab test. And I haven't talked to every single human being on the premises, but all the fighters and managers that I talked to said they didn't get a call. And so I don't know if it takes a little longer than usual, but I kind of feel like for peace of mind, it would have been nice to get that phone call before the fight. But they've now done it twice, and everyone seems confident that this is going to go.
Ariel Helwani is joining us. All right, so you spoke to Tony Ferguson the other day, and a lot of guys in his situation having to deal with the change in dates, the change in venue, a change in opponents, might be pretty worn down by now. He's just been through maybe the longest camp of his entire career. So what's your sense as to where he is mentally and psychologically coming into this one?
Yeah, not only the longest camp, but he's also made weight twice in the past 3 weeks.
Right.
Because, you know, they were scheduled to fight on April 18th, and then the plug gets pulled from that card, and he just decides to make weight. He started that week, the week of the 18th, he started it weighing 179 pounds, and on Friday morning, he weighed in at 155.
Wow.
For what reason? No one really knows. He just said he wanted to prove a point, and he wanted to go through the usual fight week. He didn't get paid to do that or anything like that. 3 weeks later, he comes back. He makes 155 again, but I've talked to everyone. You know, if you know a little bit about Tony over the past couple of years, he's had some issues, some personal issues, some mental health issues, and everyone that I've talked to has said he's in an incredibly good mood. His spirits are very high. I think he really loves the idea, finally, that he is the guy that everyone is watching, that he is getting his respect. The fact that he's never fought for the official belt is a crime. He's won 12 in a row in the best division in the UFC, and he has sort of felt like second fiddle for a long time. And now he's the A-side. He's the draw. He's the big star. And I think he is thriving in this situation. I think he loves the idea that everyone is going to be watching him on Saturday.
Now, Ariel, it's not Ferguson Khabib, but it's the next best thing. You've got Justin Gaethje. And for those who don't know the sport and don't know him, let me get your thoughts on this, because you've already said that Ferguson Gaethje is going to be amazing and entertaining, so much so that you'd stake your reputation on that. How do you see that fight going?
I foresee it being very, very fun. I foresee it being very entertaining. I think it's going to be a wild fight. I think both guys, if you know anything about them, like, okay, Ferguson, 12 wins in a row, that's incredible. But his fights are never boring. He's a very unorthodox fighter. He throws caution to the wind. He'll throw, you know, elbows when he probably shouldn't. He'll switch stances when he probably shouldn't. He's just a very, very unusual and unorthodox fighter. Doesn't mind getting cut up. Doesn't mind taking a few shots to give out a few shots. And Gaethje is somewhat similar. He's fought 6 times in the UFC. He comes from a wrestling background, but he hardly uses his wrestling anymore. And in those 6 fights, he's walked away with 7 fight night bonuses, which means he always delivers. Now, there was a point not that long ago that he lost 2 fights in a row, his first 2 losses of his pro career, and everyone kind of thought, man, Justin Gaethje hit the ceiling. Like, he hasn't figured it out. He takes too much damage. He doesn't protect himself. He's too wild. He's too reckless. Then he came back and changed his style. Didn't turn into a boring fighter. Didn't turn into a cautious fighter, but just a more relaxed fighter, and trusted his striking and didn't feel like he needed to take, you know, 2 punches to give out 3. And that has resulted into a very, very good Justin Gaethje, a better Gaethje than we saw initially. He's now won three in a row, and all of those fights have ended in the first round via finish. So I'm curious to see if whether or not he remains relaxed out there and uses the boxing and the striking that he's used in the last three fights, or if Ferguson's crazy style brings out the old Justin Gaethje. But yeah, I can foresee, unless there's a low blow early on or an accidental eye poke or something like this, I could foresee no scenario where this fight doesn't live up to our expectations.
I'm with you on that. I can almost guarantee it. I would spend your money. I'm going to spend my own money on that, but I would spend anybody's money on that. It's going to be a great, great fight. And it's a card, Ariel, with a dozen really good fights. We can't get to all of them, of course. But before I let you go, let me ask you about Henry Cejudo and Dominic Cruz. Cejudo bought a bag filled with stuffed heads of Demetrius Johnson, TJ Dillashaw, and Dominic Cruz to the face-off with Cruz. What did you make of that?
Oh, I love it. I love that kind of stuff. Those theatrics are fun. Cejudo has turned into one of the best characters in our sport. And in case your audience doesn't know him, 2008 Beijing Olympics, youngest American Olympic gold medalist in freestyle wrestling history. At the time, that record has since been broken, but he is a prodigy. And early on in his MMA career, he kind of started out a little slow. He was very raw, but he's turned into one of the best fighters on the planet. And what he's done is created this persona, Triple C, the king of cringe, and he does fun things like this that the fans sort of roll their eyes to, but they also can't get enough of it. They keep watching, and he's turned into a great heel as well. So he beat DJ Mighty Mouse, he beat TJ Dillashaw, and then he kicked the Dominic Cruz head. And the Cruz story is phenomenal, too. The guys have fought in 3.5 years, the best bantamweight champion of all time, coming back from shoulder surgery, multiple ACL surgeries, and now here he is trying to fight the champ, trying to shut up the guy that he used to train with back in the day in Arizona wrestling. I mean, this is the stuff that a promoter dreams of. So actually, if I'm being honest, the co-main event between those two guys is more intriguing to me than the main event because of that storyline.
It's amazing, and he has not fought since 2016. Last thing, you spoke to Conor McGregor's manager, who said that he'll be watching tomorrow night. What is he looking to see, and what might that mean for Conor's next fight?
Yeah, he's looking at two things. He's obviously interested in that main event because he could fight either Ferguson or Gaethje next. They fight in the same division, but if you followed Conor over the last 2 months, I would argue that this has been the best two-month stretch in Conor's career because he has really matured in front of our eyes, and it's good to see, especially after the year that he had last year. He's been very vocal about, you know, the state of Ireland and, you know, trying to be as safe, social distancing, lockdown. He's donated over €1 million in PPE equipment to local hospitals. He's visited children's hospitals. I mean, he's done a phenomenal job being a role model. But Adi Tar, his manager, told me that he's obviously interested in that fight, but he wants to see how the UFC pulls off this event. He wants to be assured that it is healthy and safe and it's being done the right way, not just for the fighters, but for the staff themselves. And there is an offer on the table for him to return in July. But until he feels reassured that these fights can go off the right way, he's not going to consider that offer. So he is very curious to see, not just this week, but the aftermath. Does anyone walk away sick? Is anyone really ill afterwards? And then he will seriously consider an offer to fight this summer.
Ariel, go off the board for me quickly. I know you're watching The Last Dance. As one of North America's most passionate Knicks fans, what has it been like for you to watch that series?
Oh, my gosh. Thank you for asking. I have loved every second of it. It's scratched that nostalgic itch. It's been incredible. My friend Jason Hare is the director, and I'm very proud to know him because I think they've done a phenomenal job. But, you know, watching last week 93 and knowing that they went up 2-0 and then knowing the Charles Smith moment was coming, I will admit part of me, it's a very sad thing to see because I was devastated as a 13-year-old back then. But also I will admit I'm happy that my Knicks get their due. I'm happy that younger people are learning that those Knicks were badasses. They were some of the toughest opponents that the Bulls ever faced, and they should have won that series in 1993. And 92 actually hurt me more because if you recall, they took them to 7 games and they had no business going to 7 games with those Bulls. X-Men was part of the reason why they took them to 7 games. The great Xavier McDaniel, and unfortunately he then signed with the Boston Celtics, and I always thought that was a big blow for them. But Patrick doesn't get his due. And can I just make one big plea? Please, Charles Oakley, we love you, but please stop taking shots at Patrick Ewing. You are turning the fans against you. This is not the way to do it. We all had your back with James Dolan, but taking shots at Ewing during this time is not the way to go. I know you're friends with Michael Jordan, but the reason those Knicks teams lost was not because of Patrick Ewing. I can assure you of that.
You know, I can appreciate that sentiment. I love Oak. I love Charles Oakley. I know you like him. I know you respect him. I know where you're stuck in the middle of that. I will say this, Ariel, a couple of thoughts. One thing, and I tweeted this right when it happened, I got absolute chills when John Starks went baseline on Mike offhand. I mean, one of my favorite moments ever in the association. That was so macho, and that was so manly. You mentioned Charles Smith. I used to have him on the show. You know, not to date myself, but I've done this long enough. Man, he was a good dude. Good dude, good player. When that moment came up and you knew it was coming, did you cover your eyes or did you stand in and watch it?
No, I was jumping up. I was like, okay, go. And you have to understand, I lived in a house with two older brothers.
I mean the rear. When it came up on the last dance.
The rear. Well, I went back to those old memories because they were Bulls fans.
Yeah, right.
You know, you watch it every time and you're like, how, A, did they not call a foul? Come on, there was at least one foul in the midst of that sequence, I believe. At least one. I know I sound crazy saying this now, you know, what, 27 years later, whatever it is, but I believe. And I couldn't agree more about the Starks moment. I had that poster over my bed. I had the T-shirt. To me, John Starks represented what the Knicks were all about. This guy who was bagging groceries, Oklahoma State product. No one wanted him. He was in the CBA. He was a Pat Riley guy. And I will never love anything more in sports than those teams in that era, up until, you know, the 2000 Knicks. By the way, the 2000 Knicks don't get talked about enough. Patrick Ewing in the second round beating the Miami Heat. Morning tries to cheat and he dunks on him in game 7. That team doesn't get talked about enough for the grittiness. The guy could hardly walk at that point. He was hobbling up and down the court because of the Achilles. Anyways, I digress. I love that team, and I feel like they don't get their due, and I just wish they would have gotten one ring. Just give me one ring. 94 was our chance. We all know it. Hakeem blocked that shot. I wish Starks would have given it to Ewing in the post in Game 6. They had their chance up 3-2. You're getting me all fired up here, Jim.
I love it, man. I love it. That's sports. I love it. Ariel Helwani, a journalist for ESPN, and we do have sports. We've got UFC 249 coming up this weekend in Jacksonville. Ariel, great job. Appreciate you. Great to have you back on, and we'll do it again soon. Nicely done by you.
Anytime. Thanks for having me, Jim. All the best.
Glover Quinn. Glover, I want to talk to you first about, before we get to the show, how are you and your family doing in the middle of this really, really unusual time? What's it like for you and yours?
Oh, man. First of all, what's up, man?
What's up, man?
On the show.
You too. Good talking to you.
Oh, man. You know, we're here in Houston, and we've just kind of been hanging out at the house, you know, staying in. We actually, I mean, we kind of started naturally kind of staying away in, like, mid-March. We didn't travel for spring break. So we stayed home. We've been inside since, like, March the 9th, I think. And we just kind of hang out at the house. You know, we do a bunch of activities with the kids. Obviously, we're doing the homeschooling stuff. We go out in the backyard. We got a nice space. We live out in the suburbs. And so we got a nice space to go out in the backyard and let the kids play and kind of entertain ourselves at our house and not have to be out as much. So it's been good. And, you know, the kids play their video games and we do get some work in. They do the baseball stuff. And so it's been good. I mean, we've had a lot of good time just to be at home as a family and kind of let our lives slow down a little bit. So that's been great as well. So, you know, we've been trying to hang in there and ride this thing out, staying safe.
That's how you do it. Good to hear it. All right, so when you and I spoke about your retirement last summer, I got to know, it's been a year already, which is hard to imagine, but what was that first year of retirement like for you?
You know what? It was actually kind of cool because, you know, I kind of took a step back from football, not watching it every day, all day. Kind of gave myself some time to kind of just dive into other things. And, you know, yeah, I would watch games on Sundays and, you know, we would sit down and watch, you know, the football games, but I wasn't watching all of the stuff leading up to the games and, you know, watching OTA stuff and just kind of a lot of the stuff that go with football that I used to watch and take so much time. So I kind of gave myself a break from it. And I just dove into, you know, more time with my family, you know, taking advantage of that. And working on some different hobbies that interest me. And so that's when I got started into videography. Just, you know, I've always loved cameras and, you know, I wanted to, you know, edit videos because my kids play baseball. So I'd make like little highlight videos for them. And, you know, as a professional athlete, I was kind of like, man, if I'm going to do something, like I want to be good at it. Like I don't want to just make average videos or have a camera and not really know how to work it. Like, I want to be good at it. So that kind of prompted me to say, you know what, I got some time now. I'm going to go, like, to film school and kind of, like, learn more about filming and editing and all that stuff, and that led to another thing, and it's been almost a year now that I've had my camera been working at it. So it's been fun. It's been a good, cool journey for me to kind of attack the creative side of my brain that I didn't really use as much when I was, you know, focusing on football. So it's been fun. It's been fun.
Clover Quinn is joining us. You know, watching this show, I'm not surprised at all, but you approach the show and you're on camera the way you always were when you were on this show, and the way you conduct yourself as a player, you're going to shoot straight. You're going to be honest. As an example, you talked about the fact that when you signed with the Lions, nobody from the team reached out to you. 3 weeks after you signed, Don Carey was the first guy to contact you. How did it feel then to sign with a team and not have any of your teammates reach out? What did you think at that time?
Well, you know, at the time, you know, it was kind of like, I guess, the self-fulfilling prophecy, you know, because back then, Detroit Lions did not have a good reputation on the field. They were probably the most penalized team, personal fouls, off the field. They had a bunch of off-the-field issues going on. So just nationally, Detroit did not have a great rep. And so when I signed there, you know, it really didn't surprise me. Because I had never, you know, I had never went through that process anyway, so I didn't know what it was supposed to be like. But I just know the feeling that it gave me. Like, I was like, dang, man, I think I signed the biggest contract out of all the free agents that year, and nobody from the team, like, hit me up and was like, what's up, man? Like, glad to have you on the squad. And I wasn't, like, super, you know, highly known or whatever, but I was still like, man, if you keep up with your team, we just signed, like, a safety and, like, you know, he's going to be on that team. But, you know, it was nobody. And, you know, when I first got there, I could feel the tension. I could feel the, you know, the hate, just because there were some other guys on the team that wanted to be paid, that probably deserved to be paid, but they didn't get paid. And so my message was, hey, man, there's no need to be mad at me. I didn't call Detroit and ask them to sign me. They called me. So if you're going to be upset with anybody, be upset with the front office. Be upset with the position coaches that said, hey, we need to add a safety, and we're willing to pay him this much. Don't be upset with me. But like I said, I had to deal with that, and it was you know, it was tough. It was tough. But my goal, my mission was, you know what? Just because I felt this way, I'm going to change that for the next guys that are coming in. And so I started reaching out to anybody that we signed as a free agent, you know, draft pick. I was hitting the GM up, that year Coach Caldwell got hired. I hit Coach Caldwell up, you know, and I knew he was busy, but I still just wanted to send him a text or something just so he know that I reached out to him. My DB coaches, I reached out to them just to welcome them to the team, welcome them to the city. It was just something that I wanted to take pride in, just because, like I said, I had that feeling. I know what it felt like for me, and I wanted everybody to feel welcome. I didn't feel threatened by anybody that we signed. I knew who I was as a player. I knew what I could do, and so I knew everybody coming in was there to help us. And the only way they can help us is if they feel a part of the team and they feel welcome, then they feel like we want them there so that their talents can truly show. So that was something that I wanted to do. So that's what I did to the DB room. I wanted to welcome everybody in, like, man, let's have a great time, man. Feel free to be yourself, and let's work together and do this thing.
Like I said, keeping it real and shooting it straight. And there's a brand new program, and it's called the DB Room. Glover Quinn is the host. It's on YouTube. Let me ask you this. You did a deep dive on your pick six against Matt Ryan back in the day on the program. The night before the game, you were watching film on Ryan. You saw him do a check at the line. What about that caught your attention? And then what did you do with that knowledge?
You know, so when I was in Houston, Matt Schaub, Kyle Shanahan was the offensive coordinator when I was in Houston my rookie year. In 2009, Kyle Shanahan was the offensive coordinator. And when we were in practice, Matt Schaub used to do that all the time. He would do the little check, and it was, you know, he was saying can. I didn't know what Matt Ryan was saying, but in my head he was saying can because Matt Schaub was the backup quarterback in Atlanta at the time, and Kyle Shanahan was the coordinator, I think, the year, maybe 2 years before. So Kyle Shanahan had been in Atlanta with Matt Ryan. So when I saw him do that, it kind of caught my eyes. I was like, hold on, I've seen that before.
Right.
And, like, I started to pay attention to it. And so then I started going back and looking at all the plays, because that route is it's a hard route to defend, but it's a big play for the offense because, I mean, I showed it in the video. They try to hit Julio, and then that other receiver is blocking the safety, and Julio is circling the defense going 75 yards for a touchdown. A lot of teams run that play because it's a tough play. But we always talk about we can make an interception if we get a good read on it. And so once I just started looking at all of them. And I was like, man, 95% of the time when they run this play, he's making this check. Like, he's doing this. I was like, hold on, okay. So they're coming out in this run formation look type of thing. And if he gets the look that he wants, he's checking to the little skinny. And so I saw enough to feel confident and like, hey, if I get this look, like, I'm going to make this play. But I had to communicate that to Slay because he was going to be the guy that was on Julio that would have to have my back if they didn't throw the ball. So I left the meeting. I go tell Slay what I saw. I'm like, bro, I can go make this play. We're going to make this play when we get it. And that's just the beginning of it. A lot of people, you know, a lot of times you see stuff and you have a good idea. But to recognize it in the heat of the game with 80,000 people screaming and to be able to go and execute it, that's a whole different subject. And so being able to see it just that quickly, like I said, and at first I didn't recognize it. It didn't trigger in my brain until he checked. When he checked and did the little can-can, whatever thing he did, when he did that, it clicked in my head. And I was like, oh, snap, here it goes. I tried to catch up, tried to tell Slay, like, Slay, this is it. And had to take a chance on it, and that was a true story behind how that play. And me and Slay talk about that play to this day, and he's still like, man, that play give me chills still to this day.
Glover Quinn is joining us. If you want to learn how to play in the secondary, or if you want to learn how DBs think, this is why you want to watch his show. Before I let you go, you mentioned Slay, and I love Slay. Slay is one of my favorites. After he was dealt to Philadelphia, he talked about the fact that when Matt Patricia came in, he had a very different approach, and you've touched on this as well. But let me ask you, if you're a first-time head coach, the way Patricia was, a first-time head coach, and you're coming to a team that's 9-7 and that is competitive, and the first thing you're talking about is changing the culture, what's your reaction, and did that come off to you as arrogant?
Yeah, it definitely came off as arrogant. And I think coaches, and I don't want to speak for every player, but I can speak for the majority of players and the majority probably of the world. The New England Patriots have this arrogancy about them, right? They're just the way people think about it. And rightfully so, they've won a lot of Super Bowls, been to a lot of Super Bowls, won a lot of games, right? So a lot of people think the New England Patriots people are arrogant. They feel like they're better than other people. And so for new head coaches that are coming out of the New England system, that is already against you as a coach. So you can't come in and treat the people like you're better than them. Like, that already comes off in a negative light. And I felt like that's what he did. You know, we had been 9-7, I think, the last 2 years. We have made the playoffs. You know, we have made the playoffs twice in 4 years. You know, had two winner-take-all divisional championship games in week 17. So it wasn't like we were the bottom of the food chain. We weren't the bottom of the barrel like this team that's 0-16 or, you know, 4-12 that you really got to come in and just uproot everything. We were a team that was right there at the cusp. And, you know, we just needed a little boost to maybe get to 10 wins or 11 wins. That's all we did. We didn't need a complete overhaul. You know, the players that we had were good players. So to come in and just kind of, you know, dog the players, dog, like, you know, make it seem like everybody in the organization was, like, bad and you had to change this and change that, it didn't come across great. And so that's why there was some kickback, some drawback, and you know, but, you know, he's in year three now, and, you know, he's been there some years, so I'm sure he's learned a lot over this time, and you know, hopefully this is a good year for him. And by the way, Slay's going to be on the show live Wednesday.
Good.
In the DB room.
Good. He's going to be on, and you've got first-round pick Jeff Okuda coming on as well. So when you and Slay chop it up, what's that going to look like and what's that going to sound like on the DB room?
Well, the thing about the DB room that I wanted is I'm big into stories. I feel like everybody
yes.
has a story.
You get that.
That makes them who they are. And so everybody know what Slay do for a living. Everybody know he's a great, phenomenal football player. But I want people to know who Slay is, not what he does. So, like, let's talk about, like, your journey, trials that you went through, things that you dealt with to make you who you are. Why do you have this funny personality that everybody loves? Like, why do you look at the game the way you look at it? Why do you look at life the way you look at it? What has happened? Because there's so many people that's dealing with so many things that can relate, you know what I'm saying, like to life stuff. Everybody can't relate to what it's like to play in the NFL. Like, everybody can't do that. But life situations, things that are happening on a daily basis, how we deal with stuff, a lot of people can relate to that. And so that's kind of what I want to highlight, you know, motivate people, inspire people to, you know, go after whatever it is they want to go after and start to see us as good human beings that play football, you know. So
you get this, dude. This is why you and I go back as far as we do and why we've always done this. You understand this. You get this, that the best interviews are not interviews, but they're conversations. The best conversations are when guys get kind of anecdotal and they can tell a story or two. The thing I love about Slay, Glover, and it's this thing I love about a lot of guys, Slay loves being Slay, and I mean that in a really good way. Like, he loves right. being him and is happy to tell you about him and can express himself really well, and he's comfortable being him. Those are my favorite right. kind of guys. Guys like that. Slay likes being Slay, and that's good.
Right. And that's one of the reasons why we have such a great relationship, because Slay came in and he's been right at my hip the whole time. And he's never been afraid to, like, ask me questions. He's never been afraid to admit what he wasn't good at, what he wasn't comfortable doing in life, like things that, like, decisions he had to make. He's never been afraid to just be like, bro, I don't really know what to do. Like, I need some help. Like, and that's big, because a lot of guys won't do that. They'll just fake it or whatever. Like, he's never been that way. He's always asked for advice and help and, like, and didn't have a problem with it. So I feel like that's a huge trait to me, just saying, hey, man, I'm not too proud to say that I need some help. I don't know a lot of stuff. I want to learn. I want to be better. Like, ask people. There's people on this earth to help people. So don't be afraid to reach out to people that God has put in your life to help you become a better person. So, I love Slay. He's like a little brother to me, man. So I can't wait to have him on and you know, just let him talk about it.
He is an all-pro, a Pro Bowler, a 10-year NFL vet. He's got a brand new show. It's called The DB Room. He is the host, and it's on YouTube, Glover Quinn. My man, I'm so glad we got caught up. Congrats on your new show. Good to run you down, and let's not wait another year. Let's be sure we do it much sooner next time.
All right, man, let's do it.
Yo, Jay.
Wait, what?
Welcome to the jungle. A tremendous Monday to you. Blur Day. Monday, what's up? Got a good show for you. Fresh show, different show, lots to get to. Let's not waste any time. Let me start with a quick recap of The Last Dance. Michael Jordan hates Jerry Krause.
I hate
him. You had Michael Jordan hates Isaiah Thomas.
Red
and you had somebody else getting humiliated.
Clyde was a threat, but me being compared to him, I took offense to that.
Damn. The hell did I ever do to this guy? I'll tell you what you did, Clyde. You played well enough for somebody else to compare you to him, and now it's your ass, Clyde.
They should have just titled this doc,
"Here's a List of Guys That Michael Jordan Hates."
Nick Chubb joining us. If I were to get you to look back on last season, what kind of thoughts do you have?
Yeah, we thought we were a lot better than we were. And we got this guy. We got this guy. Man, we're straight. We don't need to actually work. What's going to happen for us? Because, I mean, we're just so naturally talented. I mean, we had all the talent in the world, but we just didn't, you know, put the work into it.
Of course, we'd be getting closer to being allowed to go back outside. But look what's waiting for us. The Murder Hornets. You think it sucks being inside? Try going outside. All of a sudden, quarantine sounds pretty damn good. Ben Mesrick joining us.
There's lots of craziness going on in this world right now, Jim. And I'm just sitting here in my bunker with Toby from Houston, you know.
Larry
hanging
Brown.
Out, checking out.
There you losers go. You got what you wanted. Ben's throwing you a bone.
I love the clones.
10 junior bacon cheeseburgers.
Yo, big dog, what's your address? We want to come over and study the Chiefs. My address? My address is Wendy's. You mark me down for 10 cheeseburgers.
Fat.
Oh, it's just one game. If I've said it once, I've said it 1 million times. You cannot win a title in May. But damn, it feels good to have baseball back. The KBO back. I'm thinking about making this the new show theme. We've had a good run, Iggy Pop. I may bust out with this at the top of every hour going forward.
Live from Southern California.
Welcome to the jungle, a tremendous man. Dana White joining us.
It wasn't even that, oh, we need to be first. I just knew we would be. You telling me right now that they couldn't go ahead with golf? You just have to spend the money to be safe. And that's what we do for the last 20 years.
Oh my gosh, dude. I love Dana White right now. This is a better Nat Nation to be a part of.
Are you a pilot?
Yeah, everybody covers each other's back a little bit. People get tired. We can get a little shut-eye when we need to.
Said I'm going to kill Jim Roman if I ever see him, and he's a piece of you.
He was on a satellite link-up, and I was still terrified. And I am right now hearing that back because Mike is still doing damage. James Devlin is joining us. You used to smoke guys like Rob Gronkowski and the other tight ends when it came to lifting.
I was never really the most gifted athlete. I was never the fastest. I was never, you know, the biggest. But one thing I could always control was my strength.
But do you really want to go into space with a guy who may have just named his kid XAEA12?
Stink.
I'm telling you, man, not going to think about yourself. Think about me.
You complete me.
Emailed.
Hello.
Not fat.
I love it.
From my new size. It's been a year since I ate pie, and now I'm sorry. I ever sent back the dessert cart.
God bless you, Mr. Brady. Your sperm is mighty. It's such a coincidence he is playing for Tampa now, because I've been wanting to Tampa him for years. Want to Tampa with that guy. Jim, I'd do things to him that you wouldn't do to a barnyard animal.
Welcome to the smack off, Sarah. Now we know why these guys are producing TV and not running sports leagues. Because if they had it their way, women would be sitting amongst holograms, waiting to see whether or not they could have sex with the person they're already married to.
Sex with me.
Mom and dad, he's an alcoholic.
Twitter.
Number two, I said Scott Burrell, not Scotty Farrell.
Not Ryan.
Scott Burrell.
You are despicable.
Right.
You're a moron.
Right.
You're an idiot.
Right.
Loser.
Keep Scotty Farrell's name out your mouth.
Keep my name out your mouth.
And stuff like this happens, bro. You know,
no, stuff like that does not happen, bro. Just you, Earl.
Happens to us all.
I've got something for all you hoes. Yeah, you do. Nick Rolovich is my guest.
Code word Romy. Where are all those cougar clones at? They're out there, there's got to be some cougar clones out there.
Why is that an issue? Because we talking about basketball.
Forget practice. The best delivery in the entire press conference is how he just blurts out,
Phillip.
Mike Budenholzer is their head coach. What are you doing with Netflix?
Was Yellowstone. Third season of Ozark. Thought I would never, ever, ever watch Game of Thrones. All of a sudden, I'm kind of getting into it a little bit.
Mona Shelburne is my guest.
They're going to have basketballs where that they write your name on the basketball, and like that's your basketball. No one else is touching your basketball, and you're not touching anybody else's basketball.
Glover Quinn.
The New England Patriots people are arrogant. They feel like they're better than other people.
Did you know Joe Burrow is just the command Richard Gere shouts to his pet gerbil named Joe?
Look good from the car to the bar.
NationGolfCo.com.
Yes, I am a part owner.
Part Orenthal?
Please stop taking shots at Patrick Ewing.
Keep us in your prayers.
Jim.
But bees?
Yay.
Baby fat
ball. Happy Cinco de Mayo.
I would even watch golf right now.
Are you like trying to mock me?
Thank you for holding down for the A1A, showing these kids what we can do.
Let Brooks dip.
Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Get your ass to Mars.
Oh.
I like that.
Good night now.
The size of his head, it is impossible to stay 6 feet away from him in the same room.
Omaha.
So he's not here today. But he is on the phones. And we go there right now to get his thoughts. What's cracking, Head?
Jim.
Head.
Nice to have a guy back on the board who actually knows where the hell he hit all that sound.
Yeah,
welcome
Allie. You're telling me, Head. You're telling me, Head. Nothing against you, Head, but man, you suck on the board. Dude, you're really good at lots of things, but running the board's not one of them.
No offense taken.
Anyway. Last time we had you on, Flight Deck, you were transitioning from betting on the weather and ping pong to the NFL draft. But JK, we actually have sports now. How fired up are you to get some legitimate action to finally get down on?
Oh my gosh, dude. I love Dana White right now. Let's just put it this way. I'm betting on darts now, Jim. I need some sort of action. I went from weather to table tennis to darts. And now we finally have some fights. And like you said, awesome, awesome action fights. Dude, I cannot freaking wait till tomorrow night.
Okay, but let's not get personal about this, right? I mean, were you getting paid on darts? Were you making money betting darts?
I'm hitting about 500. I got a -1.5 on Jared Cole later tonight in the Icons of Darts Live League. So
good luck with that.
We can get over that. Yep.
Good luck with that. All right, so why don't we start with the main event? We got a real event coming up this weekend. You've got the interim lightweight UFC championship strap. Tony Ferguson versus Justin Gaethje. No, it's not Khabib v. Tony, but it's a badass fight between two tough-ass dudes. Ferguson is -190. He's a solid favorite. You can get Gaethje at +155. Who you got head?
You give me 155 on plus for Justin Gaethje. Jim, I'm taking Gaethje, actually. I'm going the underdog here. Look, Tony Ferguson is an animal. I've wanted to see him and Khabib fight for years, and I honestly don't know who wins that fight. Tony has won 12 fights in a row, and for a UFC fighter, that is historic. And he's well-rounded, Jim. He's awkward. He's very, 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 very hard to prepare for. He punches, he kicks, he elbows, he knees. I mean, he is an entertaining fighter as it comes. And, I mean, you just need to Google his opponents, and you'll see what he does to them. He absolutely pummels them. But you know who else likes to put people in a lot of pain? That'd be Justin Gaethje, Jim. Nobody does it at a bigger clip than Justin. He stands in, and he goes at it. He's not afraid to stand in the pocket, take pain. And he's a little bit more tactical in his last three fights, Jim, which I'm pulling off of. And he's finished those guys in the last three, in the first round of the last three fights. And he's 21-2 overall. I think if he actually was tactical with his other things, I don't think he's ever loses, Jim. I think he's that good. And I love Tony Ferguson, but +155 for Gaethje, I'm taking it.
You know what? I see it working. Son, I see you taking a shot at Gaethje at +155. Personally, Deck, I cannot go against Tony Ferguson. But that said, I'm not saying he can't lose. He hasn't lost in 12 straight, but he can. If somebody can get him, it's Gaethje, except I can't pull the trigger there. Really quickly on the entertainment value, it may not be the fight that we all wanted, Khabib, Tony, but it's the next best thing. Do you think maybe it's more entertaining, though, than Khabib and Tony?
Well, you know, the aura and the atmosphere of a Tony v. Khabib fight would be incredible. There's no doubt about that. But stylistically, because of how these two dudes do their work, yeah, it should be. I mean, if you had Khabib, I personally still love it, but it becomes a question of whether Tony, or even Justin for that matter, can stop his grappling. Will he get his takedowns or will he not? Because Tony and Justin both have world-class, not world-class, but they have high-level wrestling. So the thought is, can they stop Khabib? But for fans, like, these two are wrestlers, but they do not go by that. I mean, this is a blood.
All right, too technical. Let's stick to betting. All right, my fault. I shouldn't have asked you that. Let's stick to the betting. We're talking to the flight deck, James Kelly. Listen, his head is huge. He's got lots of information rattling around there.
Yeah.
He just took the underdog in that fight. If you want to get paid and you want to take a shot, maybe that's where you go. All right, the co-main event is Henry Cejudo's bantamweight UFC belt, which is up for grabs. He's defending against Dominic Cruz, who many believe is the greatest bantamweight of all time. Cejudo is favored at -240. -240. Cruz checking in at +190. Who are you hitting here and why?
Jim, I'm going to underdog again here. I'm actually going to hit Dominic Cruz at +190. I love Cejudo. He's next level. He ended Mighty Mouse's run as a flyweight champion that lasted for years. He destroyed TJ Dillashaw, and then he's moved up to this bantamweight, and he took the belt there. And for years, I mean, I've watched this guy for probably 13 years, and for a lot of people who don't know Cejudo, he'd be like the LeBron James of the wrestling community. Like, this kid was a prodigy, Jim, when he's younger. So I love him to death, but if there's one person who I think can maybe handle this guy, it's Dominic Cruz. Dominic's IQ is the highest I've ever seen for a fighter. He is so brilliant. So if there's anybody that could possibly have a game plan or the proper way to go at Henry, I think it's Cruz. I'm going to take the +190, Jim.
All right, so the +190. Listen, Cruz has not fought since December 2016. I personally cannot get beyond that. Again, I think in terms of a pure fighting or pure fighting ability, he can win the fight, but you want to talk about ring rust. Personally, I can't get beyond that, so I'm going to go chalk. Now we've got a really interesting heavyweight fight between two dudes who can really bring the heat. Francis Ngannou and Jair Rozenstruik. Two really dangerous dudes. Ngannou is -275. Rozenstruik is +215 as the dog. Are you going to take a third dog in a row, flight deck?
No, I'm going to go the minus 275, Jim, on Ngannou here. Look, it's not a bad bet to take Rozenstruik. I mean, that's plus 210. And both of these guys, I mean, they're the two hardest hitting MMA fighters on the planet, maybe. I mean, these guys bring heat, Jim. It's like Tyson Wilder when it comes to fighters for UFC fighters. They're going to stand in and they're going to swing. Again, theme of this card, unbelievable fights for Dana. And this guy, I mean, this one's going to be great. I mean, all you have to do is Google Alistair Overeem's lip, and you'll see what Rozenstruik does to people. But having said that, this is a step up in competition. Francis, he wants a rematch for that heavyweight championship belt. His last three fights, Jim, he's finished in a total of 2 minutes and 23 seconds. And two of those three guys, Cain Velasquez and Junior Dos Santos, legends of this game.
He is the flight deck. His head is gigantic. He's got all sorts of info rattling around. One last one. Another interesting fight. A couple of big names running it back in a fight, JK, they had in 2013. Welterweights, Anthony Showtime Pettis, Cowboy Cerrone. Pettis finished the Cowboy in the first round of their first fight. Cowboy admitted that when he fought Conor McGregor last out, he was not ready. Pettis is the favorite, minus 150. You can get the Cowboy, though, at plus 125. Are you buying the Cowboy?
I'm buying the Cowboy, another underdog, Jim, plus 125. Yes, he's lost his last three fights, and he hasn't looked good. But remember, they were against Conor, Justin, and Tony Ferguson. Also, this card, Jim, it's not in a main event, and Cerrone has always showed up better when he's not the center of attention. He seems like in a good place this week from the interviews and the clips that you've seen. So I'm going to go with the Cowboy, plus 125, and again, it should be an entertaining fight between the two of these guys. But Pettis, he's just not the fighter that he used to be. I mean, I think he's lost probably 8 of his last 12 fights. So I'll take the underdog on this, plus 125.
James Kelly, all fired up. We've got UFC 249 coming up this weekend in Jacksonville. You've got something to watch, something to do, something to get down on. All right, so really quickly, I've got about a minute left. Those are the things you're going to hit for UFC 249. Are you looking at anything else anywhere, be it on that card or outside that card? What's a guy to do to get down?
I'm looking everywhere, Jim, like always. I've put a lot of action on some of my future bets for the NFL. I believe the Tennessee Titans have gotten a stupid number after the draft. I think I got them at 35-1. I'll take them. And the Minnesota Vikings, another one that is dumb, 28-1 odds. Of course, I'll take those guys, and then I'll take one of the favorites to kind of, you know, make that a safe bet.
That's what you do. I've seen you do this. You take a couple of shots, and then you go with something that's got a lower number. You kind of hedge. I've seen that. Now, were you or were you not the guy that when the Bears got Nick Foles, didn't you hit that? And what number did you get that?
What did I get Nick at? I would say I got the Bears at plus 35-1 odds. I like that bet. I mean, if anybody's better than what Mitchell has put out there, I mean, a quarterback who's won and won a Super Bowl, and that team from 2-53 is pretty good. So I got them at 35-1 too.
Let's go to Laguna Beach. The Laguna Beach Bully. Lef in Laguna. What's going on, Lef? How are you?
Not much, Jim. I'm doing good. How are you?
Good, bud. Good.
Hey, man. I love the interview earlier with Glover Quinn talking about his podcast, The DB Room. Before that interview, I just assumed the DB Room was Brad and Crona and all his D-bag buddies he's brought to the jungle lately. You know, like Reggie and Taco or Taxi, whatever that guy's name is. Anyways, Jimmy, happy Friday. I noticed you're on your casual Friday attire, or if you're Hawk, the ugliest shirt he can find, which apparently, Jim, he's made into a side hustle. Jim, I saw you endorse this on Twitter over the weekend, but for those who didn't see it, Hawk's now selling 1970s vintage golf clothing. I visited the website nationgolfco.com, and I'm immediately greeted with Hawk and his five buddies looking like they're extras in an Austin Powers movie. Don't get me wrong, Hawk, those plaid bell bottoms are totally groovy. Jim, I get Hawk's company's going for that golden era of golf look, but it looks like dude's selling used clothing. Like, I'm pretty sure if I order one of those polos, it's going to come pre-shrunk, pre-pit stained, and already smelling like cigar smoke. I mean, seriously, Hawk, who's your biggest retailer for these down here? The Goodwill? Where are you sourcing these shirts from? Costa Mesa garage sales? All jokes aside, Hawk, I love the shirts. I mean, especially those deep V-necks. Hawk, do those come with an undershirt with a fake chest hair, or do I need to grow my own? Let me know.
And Hawk, I assume you did a fair amount of market research. Jim, apparently there's a healthy appetite for people wanting to dress like the dad from the Brady Bunch. Jim, I don't know if you've seen the website or not, but there's only like 9 items to choose from. 6 of them are polos, and they're all priced at the very hilarious $69. $69, Jim. Who's the pricing coordinator over there? Rob Gronkowski? Is Beavis and Butthead back there running QuickBooks? Also, Hawk, I'm not sure if you know this, but a visor's like half of a hat. The hats are priced at $11, and the visors are $20. Judging by that math, does Lewis and Palmdale have to pay double for one golf shoe? Anyways, clones, the clothes are totally far out and tubular. Check it out at nationgolfco.com. The clothes are so old, they're offering a 50% discount for World War I veterans. Just use the promo code RIT at checkout. Anyways, Jimmy, that's it for me. Have a good weekend. But I wanted to end quickly with a sports take. Jim, did you know Joe Burrow is just the command Richard Gere shouts to his pet gerbil named Joe?
That's not a good call. No.
You don't like that call.
I don't like that call. Not a very good call.
Left in Laguna, I was going to talk about how much I missed that guy, how great it was to hear his voice, that I could not rack him quickly enough. I wanted to remind him what the date was for the smack off. And then I heard the name Richard Gere. And actually, it was Richard Simmons, right? That's where he threw me. Was it, wait, quick reset. Did he reference Simmons or Gere? Okay. Because I know if there's Richard Simmons and a gerbil reference, that it was not going to be like rat or the rat family. It was the gerbil family. That's great. Left, 1994 call. They want their take back. See, Left doesn't care. Left doesn't care whether or not he gets racked because Left is made. Left knows he's won this thing twice. Left knows I can't keep him out. I can only keep him out of the studio. He can no longer bum rush the studio. Call it the Left rule or whatever you want. But I can't keep him out of the event. Like, Left could get run every single day between now and the event. Left could call every single day and talk about Richard Gere between now and the event. I can't keep him off of the invite list. Now, to be fair, it's still my bleeping show. You still need to make me want to take your call. If Left were to call every single day between now and then with a call like that or the end of the call like that, I wouldn't want to take the phone call. There's a pretty damn good chance I would not take his call that day. Except he's smarter than that. He's picking his spots. He thought he'd come in and take a bat to Adam Hawk, get racked, and keep moving. But he knows that's not good for the brand. Better to get run than to get racked. And what's the surest way to get run? Invoke the name of Richard Gere and his favorite pet. Hey, Adam, while you're here, go ahead and put him on. So what is your reaction to everything he said? You have a new company. I did tweet this out. It's a side hustle. Congratulations on that. Make sure the main thing is the main thing. Don't let it get in the way of your job, or that will be your job. What is your reaction? Are you sourcing your inventory from the Salvation Army and Goodwill and garage sales in Costa Mesa? Is that where you're getting product from?
No, that's not where we're getting product from. First of all, thank you for the endorsement. And I found Left's phone call to be hilarious. I thought it was great, very clever, a lot of truth to what he said. But not everybody has to like every style of clothing. I think people who know me know that my sense of fashion is what it is. It's kind of eclectic. I consider myself a fan of the golden era, which Left referred to.
Adam, do you get the shirts from thrift stores, garage sales, and the Salvation Army?
No. You might find some shirts that look like our shirts there because we have shirts that are made to represent a certain era. So you might find some shirts that look like it in the thrift store.
Is it a consignment shop? Are you selling other people's clothing?
No, we are selling originally designed golf clothing that celebrates
the
golden era.
Have they been worn by anybody prior to you selling them?
No, they have not.
Have they been pit stained by anybody else prior to you selling them?
No, but that was a fantastic line. I also like the line about the chest hair and the cigar smoke. If you have chest hair and like to smoke cigars and you want to dress like Arnold Palmer, go check our stuff out. But if you don't and you want to dress like a jock and a NASCAR driver, then go to Roger Dunn and buy Nike and TaylorMade. That's what I would say.
Did you just crack on Roger Dunn?
I did crack on Roger Dunn. Yes, I love that superstore, especially my local one in Santa Ana, but I don't like modern golf apparel.
Okay, so really quickly. So that was left spin on who you are and what you do and what you're selling. Give it to me straight. What is the message behind this particular company? What is it you're selling exactly?
We are selling brand new golf apparel that is modeled after the golden era when guys would wear hard collar golf shirts with nice press slacks, and they would treat golf like a day at church. You wear your Sunday's best, you go out, you don't disrespect the game. And by the way, it is a game, in our opinion, not a sport. If you can smoke a cigar and drink beer while doing it, it's a game. And you go out there to have fun with your friends and hang out for 5 hours and look good doing it. You don't go out there to try to be Tiger Woods, because there's only one Tiger Woods. So just be you and look good doing it.
So are we marketing to bros, or are we marketing to an upscale clientele, or are we marketing to clones? Who's going to buy this used this new golden era clothing?
I would say anyone that has a great sense of fashion and wants to look good from the car to the bar. Look good getting out of your car, play a great round of 18.
How badly did you want to spit that out?
Badly, because I just thought of it.
You did.
There's tee to green in golf. There's car to bar with our stuff. You can look good at the 19th hole and not look like a guy wearing some slides and a crappy untucked polo.
You look good from the car to the bar.
Yes, you can transition seamlessly from 18 to the after party and look like
a
stud.
What about the 18 holes in and around all that? Does that matter how you look then? Or only from the car to the bar?
No, it matters for the 18 holes how you look, but not how you play.
I will say one thing about the car. I did spend some time on the site. My man has got a beautiful golden era Eldorado. Sweet rig. Does he still have that car?
Yes. The founder of the company, Ryan Engel, still has the car.
Uh-huh.
He has the car. It's parked in the garage. It sips just a little bit of gas
with
the keys in his pocket.
Has he made that long walk from that car to the bar?
Not recently, because everything's closed, but yes, he has in the past. Absolutely.
Well, you're trying hard, Hawk. You're trying hard. All right. So again, what is the website? And if people want to see exactly what it is y'all are manufacturing and selling, where do they go?
I really appreciate this opportunity. It is nationgolfco.com. Nationgolfco.com. The company is called Nation Golf Company. The website is nationgolfco.com. Hats, polos, just some stuff to kind of celebrate yesteryear in golf and to not look like a NASCAR driver with a bunch of ugly logos plastered all over you.
Dude, keep NASCAR out of your mouth. They're very good to us and provide us with a lot of content and athletes. And very quickly, you were not brought in as an employee. You were brought in as an equity partner. Are you not an owner in this fledgling company?
Yes, I am a part owner.
Part Orenthal?
Part Orenthal? Well, I am murdering this segment.
Well done, Hawk.
Part owner. And yeah, it's a nice little share in exchange for some
Horrible fashion.
Yes. Good. All of the above. And by the way, thank you so much for the support and to the clones that have supported it as well. I'm trying not to, blend the two because I love the show and this is the main thing, but it happened today because I left.
No, listen, I'm having fun with you. I support this. I support your side hustle. I respect the grind. I respect the ambition. I respect what you're trying to get done. And I want to remind you, keep the main thing the main thing. Do not let that interfere with your job, or that will be your job. But I do support it. Go get it.
Thank you very much.
Go get it. Adam Hawk, owner. Adam Hawk, principal. Adam Hawk, tastemaker.
Good night.